The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. Hey, everybody. I'm Sarah Edmondson.
And I'm Anthony Ames, a.k.a. Nippy.
And we just want to welcome you to season three of A Little Bit Culty. Once upon a time, we were in a cult called Nexium.
We didn't know it was a cult when we joined, because as a wise man once said, nobody joins a cult. They join a good thing.
For a minute, it was a good thing. That's where we met, fell in love, got married, started a family.
The stuff of storybooks.
Even the part where we woke up, escaped, became whistleblowers, and helped bring it all down? You call that shit show a storybook?
Seeing the mastermind of Nexium get sentenced to 120 years in prison? That's a storybook ending, if you ask me.
The whole thing was captured on HBO's hit docuseries, The Vow.
A new season is coming out any moment, if it isn't out already by the time you hear this.
And I published a memoir called Scarred, which is available anywhere books are sold.
And now we have a podcast.
Every week on A Little Bit Culty, we call on experts, advocates, fellow survivors, and whistleblowers to help us unpack what's going on in the cultiverse.
And now we're turning our story into wisdom for other people.
Like, I wish I'd known that calling yourself Vanguard was a bit of a red flag.
Yeah, big red flag. We've got a lot to cover. So let's get this show rolling, shall we?
Welcome to A Little Bit Culty, an Acast podcast about the fads, beliefs, and trends that blur the line between devotion and destruction. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And to learn more, visit us on Instagram or alittlebitculty.com.
Here we are, the highly anticipated Mark Vicente episode. Looks like it's going to be a series.
I don't think I've ever seen so much excitement on our Instagram than when we posted Mark Vicente was going to be our next guest.
Yeah, in a short amount of time as well.
We've got it edited down to a two-parter. So this will be part one, and next week will be part two.
Mm-hmm.
And I have just been waiting so long for this, and it just feels like this was the right time. We have been gently hounding Mark to... Mm-hmm.
Gently. And by gently, I've been talking to him every 1 or 2 weeks.
I personally made a commitment to never pressure anyone to do anything ever again.
Oh, really? When did you make that commitment, Sarah?
To everyone but you.
Yeah. I didn't get that memo. You know, we forgot one thing. And
what?
I don't know if we should mention it now, but I forgot to ask him this. But it was about how, remember we were reading about how narcissists like to put people in danger? And do dangerous things, and how basically that whole entire film that he was doing when he went to Mexico, he was basically literally being put in crossfire and gunfire and having to wear a bulletproof vest for basically a jerk off film that wasn't going to get made. And he was putting his time and energy into stuff that was like.
And to clarify, it wasn't a jerk off film for Mark. It was a jerk-off
That's what I mean. It was for Keith. That's what I meant. Yeah. No.
Keith was like, go busy yourself in this project.
Yeah. And then. Was acting like he was the one who was putting himself on the line when Mark was doing it. Shit like that, man. It's just, I forgot to ask him about that. Well, maybe we'll have him on again.
Maybe we'll do an Instagram live after this podcast drops and people can...
And get to some of the questions that came up after we did our episode, because there's a lot of good ones.
Yes. And we so appreciate everyone submitting questions. I think we got to probably half of them, maybe. But it was also, this episode for us is just to catch up with a friend. And, you know, anyone who ever came to one of my infamous presentation nights, sorry, I have to roll my eyes, but I did become a presenter for ESP eventually. I was part of my job description, actually. And I would always tell my story of how I got into ESP, you have to tell your testimonial. And part of that was meeting Mark Vicente. So if anyone ever heard me share, you know, how I got there, it was meeting Mark. I met him at a film festival at a time in my life when I was really looking for something, looking for meaning, looking for community, wanting to do more than the beer commercials and vampire TV shows that I was auditioning for. Nothing wrong with those things. But I just wanted more. And Mark had made With the Bleep. I had seen it. I thought at the time, I really loved that movie. It was kind of, you know, revolutionary and mind blowing. And when I met Mark at that infamous film festival called the Spiritual Cinema Circle Festival at Sea, with all these spiritual
woo-woo.
I know, it was very woo-woo, but I was like totally in my element. I had set the intention of finding my purpose. Actually, before I even met Mark, I met another wonderful man who's still a friend of mine today, Richard, who had written this book. And I met him on the first day of the cruise, and he handed me the book, and it was called What's Your Purpose? And I was like, oh my God, the universe is providing. And it was felt, everything felt in alignment and all those things. And then the next day I sat down for dinner with Mark and his girlfriend at the time, I'm also still friends with. And we just had an incredible conversation that truly changed the trajectory of my life. And he had just taken a training, actually. So he wasn't a coach or anything yet, but he had taken a training and it really helped him, as it does at the beginning. And he told me and my boyfriend at the time, later as we got to know him on the cruise, yeah, I think you guys might really like this. And he didn't pressure me or anything to take it. It was actually somebody else on the cruise who was there to recruit, who was chasing me around for the next 48 hours with the papers. And that was actually one of my first red flags, going like, I feel really pressured and I wanted the discount, but I also wanted time to think about it. And she was on me like white on rice, as Nancy Salzman used to say. What does that even mean, white on rice?
Rice is white.
Yeah, but like, it's not on them. It is that. Like, white is not on rice. Rice is white.
There's a potential word salad right there. I don't know why it just came to me.
Anyway, needless to say, Mark and I became really good friends as we did Next Team together and eventually business partners, opened the center together. All these details are in my memoir if you want to know the full backstory. The point is, he was the one who got me in. He was also the one who got us out. Right, babe?
Mm-hmm. Mark was born in South Africa in 1965. Mark took his first photograph at age 4. Who gave him a camera? And discovered his passion for being behind the camera. Well, it was a good call. After working his way up the ranks of the camera department, his first big break came as cinematographer on the musical Serafina, starring Whoopi Goldberg. In 1992, he relocated to Los Angeles to shoot his first studio picture for Disney entitled Fatherhood. I think that's with Patrick Swayze.
From a very young age, he found himself propelled to question beliefs about the human condition. His filmmaking activism led him to make a number of films, including Encender el Corazón, about the rampant kidnapping epidemic in Mexico. That's the film we were just talking about. It was a bittersweet victory. The film touched people deeply, but was by association supporting NXIVM. Mark made the difficult decision to pull the film from distribution and, with a small band of whistleblowers, that's us, expose their criminal expertise. And as most of our listeners know, this whole shit show was captured in gritty detail on HBO's 9-part docuseries, The Vow.
Mark since developed a keen interest in exposing the coercive and duplicitous environments of high control groups. His memoir, Quest, or How the Bleep Did This Happen, will be released shortly. It chronicles the many untold stories of what occurred in NXIVM, as well as he and his wife Bonnie's harrowing campaign to escape and expose the organization. He's also in production on a documentary about malignant narcissism, which exposes abusive strategies. Mark Vicente, everyone.
Mark Vicente.
Vicente.
What up? What
Mark
up?
Mark Vicente of the filming industry.
Of the film. Oh my God. In People my have casa. Butchered my name since the beginning of time. That's all I can say.
Hey, try Nippy on for size.
Oh, man. I'm so sorry.
As I said on our Instagram post, we get requests all the time for guests, and you are hands down the number one guest request on alittlebitculty.com.
No doubt.
I don't know why. I don't get it.
I have theories
as well.
What's your theory, babe?
I can think of like a couple conversations. And the reason that I remember this is because there's a commonality to them. They just go, Vicente, it's so interesting the position he was in. It's so interesting. He's really interesting the way he does that. Mm. I think you have a level of complexity to you that gets people to want to know more.
Mm. I'm really a simple soul.
Also, a large part of our audience found us because of The Vow. And since then, people who are recovering from different groups or relationships or organizations or actual cults, and they, for different reasons, resonate with one of us or all of us in different ways. And I think that the thing that you said in the vow that is so now epically, it's become a meme. It's like nobody joins a cult.
No, they join
a good thing. And I think that that really provided a relief for a lot of people who didn't know how to explain what had happened to them. And that line for me is sort of like the headline of a whole clusterfuck of other things that comes with it that was shown in the vow as a template for people to understand how these things work. And that's really huge.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, God, I was so angry that day as well.
I remember.
I was so angry.
And guess what? It's okay to be angry, which we don't
Yeah, totally fine to be angry. I was also just, it was a collective anger at like being so tired of people just shaming us, you know, in the middle of a war, just constantly asking, well, how did you, like, how did you fall for it? How did you not see it? It was right in front of you, blah, 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 blah. It's a thing that I don't struggle with it now, but I know back then, because we were trying so desperately to explain to every single, you know, law enforcement official, every single journalist, trying to explain, you know, what this was and what had happened. And at first it seemed like nobody could get it. I know we collectively were pretty frustrated that they weren't getting it.
Your scene there, well, whatever you want to call it, that moment, most people think they're immune to this kind of thing. Even the New York Times reporter reporting on it, they don't think they're susceptible to it. And for me, I was the same guy. I was the guy who thought he wasn't susceptible to it, right? And I think when you start to flex that you're not susceptible to something, it makes you kind of more susceptible to it in a lot of ways. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to happen to you. When you're saying nobody joins a cult, you're saying, listen, if you don't think you're susceptible to this, this is what it looks like and sounds like. And so if you're talking to a lot of people that want to believe that they're not susceptible to it.
I think that's actually what the vow did. That's such a service to people is that it, I can't even tell you, Mark, how many people said, I get it now. I get it why you joined. I totally would. When episode one, sign me up, which is so vindicating.
And episode two, I'm leaving.
So vindicating. And I think that's true. I was actually one of my questions for you. It's like, how did you feel the vow served your story and was it accurate for you?
You know, the challenge always is that there's so much more to everything than what's in there. And that's 9 hours, right? So. I think for me, it was a deeply, deeply vulnerable experience. And you guys know, I mean, we all got somewhat trashed, you know, by different media campaigns that were going on. But I mean, I really felt very trashed personally. So it was very hard to be that vulnerable to sort of, you know, like we all did, you know, crack your chest open and just let it all hang out for the world. But I do think that people began to understand, especially towards the end of season one, I think they did start to understand like how much pain we were in. Because like that meltdown that happens in, I think it's episode 8 or 9, where I'm just crying, that day, and I don't remember if I said it in that moment, but that day was the day that I read the pitch that Ranieri pitched me 10 years before, you know, that story. And so the meltdown I had was because I was like, motherfucker, you played me that long. And I felt the extreme damage of like his, you know, not everybody necessarily knows this, but he loved practical jokes and his practical jokes would sometimes go on for months. And to really sort of take in like, oh, he's been playing a practical joke on me for like over a decade. That just really hurts. It doesn't hurt now because a lot of things have sort of realigned themselves. And also it was pre-trial as well.
Right. So there was no justice on the horizon.
No, not yet.
When you read
Not
that.
Yet. Yeah. But and the leading up to the trial, there was so much stress for me.
Circle back to that for a second. Remind me, did you read that pitch in the vow? You did, didn't you?
Yeah. I think I did. I don't remember.
It's a bit of a blur.
It's a little blur. I did. Okay, yeah. I mean, I read it on the stand as well. Yeah.
For those listeners who don't remember, it was like a pitch for a movie, right? Or a story that he wanted you to make?
Yeah, it was a pitch for a movie. And basically the idea was, you know, there's this corporation and there's this really good guy and he's got a mentor who's like, you know, a Jesus type character. And the two of them are talking and they realize that there's a psychopath in the organization and the good guy is going to try and find out who it is. And then what happens in the end, the trick at the end is the good guy realizes his mentor is the psychopath. Now, what was so horrible about that as well is in 2016, I was taking a walk with Ranieri and I was saying exactly that. There's a psychopath in the organization. And I didn't have these words at that point, but I was basically trying to say to him, everybody's being triangulated against everybody else and somebody's pulling the strings. There is a psychopath in the organization. But at that point, I got the wrong person. I didn't realize I was walking with the person.
Who did you think it was?
I was talking to him about Allison Mack at that point. And I said, Allison is doing some really destructive things with a woman. I don't know what she's doing, but they're doing very badly. The minute they start working with her, they do very badly. And I was yakety, 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 yak. And then he says to me, I'm just curious, when you think about things like this, do you feel these things or do you sort of calculate this understanding? And in that moment, I was like, oh, that's an interesting question. And he just took me way off topic. Later, I realized that's what he always did. The minute I got close to the truth, right, he took me off topic by giving me some really delicious intellectual concept to chew on. And, you know, me being a complete, I don't know, what do you call it? Complete prostitute for intellectual ideas. I was like, yeah, let's go there, you know? And so I was gone. So I kept on missing what was going on until it became too obvious.
Does that chap your ass?
Oh, you know what? It doesn't chap my ass as much as it did, but it still chaps my ass to some degree. I mean, what chaps my ass generally, there's many things, by the way. There's going to be many chaps my ass.
Yes. And just so you know, that's what I was going to propose is I think this should be an extended ass chapping.
Extended ass chapping.
Episode. So just feel free. You don't get one. Mark Fazenda, you have unlimited ass.
Yeah, carte blanche. Carte blanche. Write your own.
I mean, one of the things that really gets me is really the misuse and the abuse of goodwill and good intent. Mm-hmm. You know, because there's so many people, the majority of people that get roped into these things are really good people. And we know, the three of us on this podcast, because we've met a lot of them since then. These are really good people. These are people that have had some, you know, grand journey or quest their whole life of some kind. And they thought, well, every time they got into something, they probably thought, well, maybe this is the thing that really helped me overcome this or reach that or whatever, right? And it's this abuse of goodness that really, really gets to me, really chaps my ass.
Yanya Lalich, moral injury.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the one.
Yeah.
You brought up the thing with Mark in your talk. But he did the same thing with Karen Unterreiter.
Yes. Yes.
Remember when Karen Unterreiter said that she went down, I think she was down to Mexico, and he met with her and she watched him and he sat down, just gave her what she wanted, some attention, then asked for her loyalty or something like that. And that's when she knew.
Yeah. That was her way
so back. He gave you an intellectual problem to solve.
Yeah.
To distract you.
Yeah, constantly. Or he would constantly lead me to believe that his values were my values. You know, there's that whole call in the vow where I say to him, basically, I'm concerned about how everyone's doing. And I thought that we're trying to help people break through. And he says, well, if you don't know that by now, then I don't know what you've been thinking. So he sort of turns the whole thing back on me, like I'm the one not understanding. Mm. But he keeps on alluding to relinquishing morality. And that's when I say to him, like, no, that's my greatest asset. That's the thing I love the most. And then he suddenly pivots and says, I know, that's why we're such good friends. But by that point, I'm like, what the fuck is going on here? That doesn't make any fucking sense. Mm-hmm.
Wait, I need to backtrack for a second because we're going to not be on format today. So we talk about what was the hook? And can you just take us back just to remind our listeners what hooked you? And then the other thing is what did you think you were signing up for versus, you know, we know what it is now, but when you signed up, what were you diving into?
I mean, if you go back and I'll try and really shorten it, but basically my whole thing was to make the world better. My upbringing in South Africa, the things I saw, the country that was so deeply fucked up, that the family I was part of that was part of the wrong side, and the world had to be made better. And somehow I got a bug up my ass that I was going to try and be one of those people to do it. So everything was about making the world better and finding goodness and bringing goodness back and et cetera, et cetera. So everything I'd done, every, you know, different training and group and this and that and book I read, everything was about trying to, you know, figure that out. And so when I heard about, you know, ESP from Nancy and from Barbara Boucher and then later from Sarah, I thought I was going to something that was a cross between like the X-Men and Star Trek Federation. Like I thought this was going to be, they kept on talking about upstate New York. And for some reason, because I hadn't spent a lot of time up there, I thought, oh, like a really cool big house. And I started to see the X-Men Xavier's mansion in my head. So when I finally got to see the actual center, I was like, what the fuck is this? This is depressing.
Oh, yeah. Me too. It's so disappointed.
So disappointed.
Oh,
such a terrible
it's just
place.
Horrible. Gosh. And then, by the way, I'll loop back to the other part in a second. But by the way, Nancy kept on showing me pictures of albums of all these people who were smiling. And she says, look how happy they are. And I'm thinking, yeah, I've seen happy people. I don't understand. What am I missing here? She says, look how joyful they are. I'm like, yeah, but I'd seen a lot of joyful people. Anyway, the other thing was the Star Trek Federation, this idea of this futuristic group of people that everything was about making the world better. That was what I imagined, you know, and how delusional am I? Clearly very. But that's kind of what I imagined. I was carrying this idea in my mind and looking for, because I'd done so many things in my life and every single time something didn't fit for me anymore. You know, I've been in more than one cultus, as many people know. But I won't be mentioning the other cults. When I saw this, I thought, oh, great. So this is not a mystical approach. This is like a scientific approach to understand the human behavior equation. This is great. because not only do I have some things to sort out, but like I need tools to help me as an artist figure out how to, you know, get these mm-hmm. ideas out in the world. Because as you know, Sarah, when you and I met, it was, you know, it was all about the bleep at that point. You know, that was one of the attempts.
Right. And so would it be accurate to say then that ESP was the scientific balance to the mystical group that you'd been part of before? And it was like, it felt like a big jump.
I thought so.
We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org. Did anyone learn a language in high school and then let it go and then have regrets about that later? If you're anything like me, then maybe you'll relate. I did French all the way up into 12th grade, and then I let it go. I mean, I lived in Montreal for a few years and, you know, practiced a bit, but it just slipped away. And then I found Babbel. Babbel is the language learning app that sold more than 10 million subscriptions. And thanks to Babbel's addictively fun and easy little bite-sized language lessons, I've been able to get back my French. I've actually found learning French to be fun again. And c'est vrai, je parle français. With Babbel, you only need 10 minutes to complete a lesson, so you can start having real-life conversations in a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Other language learning apps use AI for their lesson plans, but Babbel lessons were created by over 150 language experts and voiced by real native speakers, not computers. Their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective. And with Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. Formidable. That means wonderful in French. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. Clearly still working on that. There are so many ways to learn with Babbel. In addition to lessons, you can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and even live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Start your new language learning journey today with Babbel. Right now, when you purchase a 3-month Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free. That's 6 months for the price of 3. Just go to babbel.com and use promo code CULTY. That's BABBEL.com, code CULTY. Our team at A Little Bit Culty Podcasts loves the Blood Ties podcast because it is gritty and current and fascinating. It's also a little bit culty. Blood Ties, the award-winning audio drama from Wondery, returns for its third season, Strange Days, with another thrilling story about greed, power, and deception. 5 years have passed since Eleanor, played by Julian Jacobs of Community, took over as CEO of the infamous Richland family empire, alongside her half-brother, Santino, played by Christian Navarro of 13 Reasons Why. Together, they decide to invest the family fortune in a groundbreaking, controversial new drug. But as shocking revelations about the new treatment emerge, Eleanor and Santino go to every length to protect their control of the Richland family dynasty. As Eleanor's father always said, medicine is a bloody business. Listen to Blood Ties, Season 3, Strange Days, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or you can binge the whole series now, early and ad-free, by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
But you were already on your trajectory.
Yeah.
That's what's interesting. It took you off it.
Yeah, it did. No, it did. Listen, people say like, oh, you know, it's when you're like, your life's shit. No, my life was fucking amazing. I mean, Sarah, you know, when you met me, things were on the up and up.
You were the guy.
Yeah, apparently. It's interesting as well, because I think, I don't know if Susan Doan's told you guys this, but like she said to me at one point, she says, listen, we studied you for quite a while. We listened to every television interview you did, every radio, everything you wrote. We'd studied everything. You didn't stand a chance against us.
No.
You know?
They probably used all their tools to build rapport.
Yeah, yeah.
For those who don't
they
know,
use
there's
the
a
jet.
Coaching class called Hypothesis of Language, yeah, where you understand the other person's language and use certain words that are going to resonate with them. I guess that's from neuro-linguistic programming.
Honestly, that just it makes me feel slimy thinking about that. And that's different than, for instance, like Sarah, when you and I met, I wasn't even trying to enroll you at that point, but I was still high on my first 16 day. But it was so sad because they used people like us who were good and genuine connectors, you know?
Yes.
And it wasn't about like a sales pitch. Because I mean, I remember even when I suggested the idea and then I started thinking, no, this would actually really help, you know? And you seemed to respond so well to what I was saying. I was thinking, this would really help. That, by the way, is the thing that's so difficult for people to understand is that up until the very end, I always thought that I was helping.
Yes.
Like I always thought that this thing could help somebody. It helped me in certain ways. It's so funny. I remember reading the Frank Report 2017, 2018, where he talked about how everybody's lives were like really falling apart in a complete failure. And I was like, yeah, it's kind of true, actually. A lot of people were really failing.
Because they were going to Albany.
Yes, exactly. That's another story.
The people that didn't go to Albany could use it like an athlete uses a gym. You didn't have to do that. You could get something out. Once you made that commitment, your life was going on a trajectory that was not going to be positive.
Exactly.
Period. End of sentence.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's what we told people, Sarah. People were going to go to Albany to work with Keith. We go, don't go.
Yeah.
Don't go.
Do you know that, Mark?
I know.
Mark knows that. Mark and I would have conversations about it. Like, don't bring him to Albany.
I was saying don't go as well.
Yeah.
When Nippy and I were considering it, and you know, I was dragging my feet for years. And then I was like, Nippy really wants to go. And then you'd be like, just don't move to Albany.
Yeah.
And that's when we had our first kind of honest conversation.
It was January 2017.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I wasn't moving to Albany because of Albany. I wanted to be closer to New York, my family, and have a house close to the airport and the train station.
Yeah.
Like they always did.
Yeah.
I remember, that's...
We were always getting shit for that. But do you feel like so many of the questions, and by the way, our the rest of our format is a mixture of things we talked about we're going to cover, and also the questions from the audience, which were about our listeners, like 130 comments we got in terms of what people want to know. 24 hours. People really want to know, you know, how you're doing. And I want to get to that. But just before we get there, we know what hooked you. And I think the vow did a good job of explaining how you got out. But really, it was Bonnie that woke up first. Mm-hmm. What was the thing that she said to you or did for you that really opened your eyes?
I mean, honestly, at the very beginning, the way this whole gaggle of, it was mostly the girls and the women would just rally around him. And I was like, something about this, I don't know what it is, you know? And then I thought, okay, well, listen, maybe there's, I don't know, daddy issues or whatever going on, but like maybe, see, the problem with this fucking tech where it's really very smart is every single time I had a concern, and you guys know this very well, it was always pointed to me about potential narrow-mindedness or inability to see the connections between things and inferring projecting my own connections on things. You know, so for instance, you know, in my very first 5 day when I said to Nancy, something fishy is going on here. And she turned the entire thing around to make it seem like that was my bad intent being projected on a system that wasn't that way. And perhaps that's what I needed to look at. So every single time, what that programmed me to start doing is every single time I did have a concern, I gaslit myself thinking, what's my limitation that I'm insisting that what I'm seeing is what I think I'm seeing? Maybe it's not, which is a horrible thing to do to people.
Or what does it mean about me that I'm even questioning this? Do I not trust the organization? Maybe I'm suppressive.
No, exactly.
I mean, also, Mark, too, because you had credibility in the organization, you were a great advocate to go do that to other people that looked up to you. So Keith abused your power through you, right? Under the premise that you were questioning people from a good place, right?
Yeah.
Because you believed, and I, as I did, and as many of us did, that that was true about the organization. It was altruistic, top to bottom.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, I was just thinking as you say that, like one of the things I don't know how you guys felt, like I never completely got the tech. There were certain things I don't understand what the fuck this is. I don't get
EMs, I gave up on. EMs, I was like, I'm not paying fucking money for this and I don't get this and I'm done trying.
And what I kept on doing in a lot of sourcings, what I was trying to do was I was trying to get people down to a true connection with themselves.
That's what I did too. I didn't follow the rules.
Yeah. I'd go off book a lot.
Yeah.
And I'd say, like, this person that's saying these things, can you hear your thoughts? And they'd say, yes, I can hear my thoughts. Can you hear the thoughts that are like, you know, saying these negative things about you? Yes, I can hear those thoughts. Okay, so who's the one listening to those thoughts? And they'd be like, be like, yeah, who's that I in there? And sometimes I'd have this moment of like, whoa, there is something in there. And I go, yeah, what if that's the real you? Like underneath all the shit, So I was off book doing shit like that. And then in the very last, I'm jumping forward, you know, many years later, in the very last intensive I was ever at, which was April 2017 in Venice, I knew at that point that the whole fucking organization was rotten. And I went in to do sourcings. And I remember I felt so shit. I was like, I had so much, I didn't even know what PTC really was at that point, but I was clearly like so reactive. And I went in and I realized I just have to fucking save face. I'm undercover. And I remember every single sourcing I did, I did not look at the piece of paper at all. I just did my thing, which is all about connecting themselves to their true essence, never mind what the piece of paper said, because I finally realized everything that was on there was coercive and trying to drive them to a conclusion that wasn't leading them closer to themselves, but further away.
Yes.
You know? And this is something I think a lot about. Everybody has some kind of connection to their true self or some divinity or some inner something, or maybe it's God or whatever it is. And to come along and to hijack that connection and then basically say that I, the cult leader, am the intermediary between you and that special divinity inside of you, that is the worst thing you can do to somebody. Because disconnecting them from that true connection to their inner whatever you call it, that their inner self, the inner child, the
higher self,
God, divinity, higher self, whatever it is, but hijacking that is the worst thing you can do. And then hijacking that for years, that chaps my ass, because that is spiritual rape. You know, that's just awful.
You say something interesting there. The 5-day kind of gets you in touch with that person.
Yes.
That's why it's powerful. And then the journey of what you talk about is the ensuing journey.
Yeah.
And I think people get messed up or not to a degree, depending on how in they went. It had seeds for future manipulation and coercion and fuck-upness if you continued and believed everything.
Well, no ultimate victims in itself is the number one precursor, I think, to the bullshit.
Yes, yes. But there's a lot of people that took that not to the nth
for
degree,
sure.
Being like, okay, something happens in my life and I can seek responsibility. And also, yeah, if somebody hurts me, I've been victimized. They don't take it as literally. But when you take it full on, there's no victims, then it's you're right for abuse. And you know, we saw what happened there.
I want to just go back because it's something I've been thinking a lot about recently. And I haven't actually even had this discussion with you guys because it's such a fresh and new thing for me. But I was going back in my childhood and sort of looking at the early beliefs I had about myself. And growing up in South Africa, there were a couple of weird ideas I got about myself. First of all, I decided white people were assholes. And then because of the abuse that I received from, you know, stepfathers, I decided men were assholes too. Plus everybody in my life was telling me men were assholes. So I had this like white people are assholes and men are assholes. And then at a certain point, I must have recognized that I am white and I am a man. So this intense self-hatred. I directed this intense self-hatred to myself. So I constantly felt not worthy and not good. So my whole life was the pursuit of goodness, which I didn't have. But somebody else must have it. And if I can just find them, then I can be somehow made pure. Okay. So my whole life is I got to find this group, this person, this something that's to find the goodness that I didn't know that I had it. I thought I didn't. So what happens is, you know, when it comes to, you know, something like ESP, then I start to feel like, oh, maybe this can help me become that. And what I've finally realized, and I'll tell you about this film I'm doing in a bit, but in interviewing a lot of the people I've been interviewing and you know, people that are self-confessed, very high-functioning narcissists as well, and I'll talk more about it another time because I don't want to give too much away, but one of them in particular said to me, you know, these people, you don't really fall in love with them. You fall in love with the version of yourself that they show you. Because what they show you is the idealized you, and it's intoxicating because that's more than anything what you want, because maybe you feel like a piece of shit and they show you who you could become and you fall in love with that. And that, by the way, explains why some of the loyalists, I think, can't let go because they're still so attached to that. You know, people said to me, there were female journalists that said to me, Ranieri's a schlub. God, he's not attractive at all. And I said, that's not why people followed him. It wasn't like they were looking to bone him. He was fucking with their head. And now I finally have the words that I didn't have all those years ago to explain to journalists, but maybe they wouldn't give a shit anyway. But basically what it is, they have you fall in love with the greatest aspect of yourself, which for me was this goodness. that was so beautiful and so profound. And that's why, as a kid, I mean, I was a Boy Scout and I was reading about Jesus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought he was like the goodest good of good. And, you know, if I could just be 1% of that, wouldn't that be incredible? Because then I wouldn't feel like such a piece of shit. So there's all this stuff I began to recognize about my psychology. And then to also just see how cruel it is, not just with me, with everybody, just to abuse your greatest wish and your greatest dream, to abuse that. And then the fallout of that. Because, for instance, one of the things that happened, and I thought about it before jumping on the podcast with you guys today, like, what are some of the effects? I mean, goodness really took a dent for me. And I've shared this with you guys before, but not with the audience. But like, when I finally realized who Ranieri was, I was like, you know what? All these motherfuckers, all these teachers, they're all like sociopaths. Mm-hmm. Fucking Jesus, sociopath. Buddha, sociopath. They're all sociopaths. And so I threw everything out. I threw everything good. I didn't care if there was a shred of goodness. Fuck them all. And so it affected that. I mean, not forever. It affected that, but it also affected my experience of friendship, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I tell you, as a guy, it's, and Nippy can relate to this, it's really hard to make great male friends. It's not an easy thing. There's all this stuff in the way, and, you know, to finally be vulnerable with each other, it's not easy. So to have somebody like a Ranieri pretend to be that friend and then realize like how full of shit and evil he was really affected my experience of like friendship.
And for so long, 13 years.
All these effects that have happened. Now, look, I mean, in terms of like how things are now, things are, you know, obviously way better now. But I really saw how it affected some of the most cherished things that people hold dear, which is why I think it takes so long to recover. Mm-hmm. Because all this goodness gets affected. Your spirituality gets affected. Your experience of who you think you are. Your trust in yourself. Your trust in others.
Anything.
I mean, I am very cautious about putting my faith in fucking anything except me. And even then, I don't entirely trust myself anymore in the way I used to. So I'm not even putting full trust in myself. It's coming back, you know, but it's been a hard road.
A couple of our listeners wanted to know if you'd forgiven yourself for getting involved in the first place.
Yes. Yes, I have. There's a few things that happened. The one thing is I dug very deeply into what I thought I was doing, and all I've ever wanted to do is help. Mm-hmm. I mean, to this day, I mean, sometimes somebody calls me and they need something and I'm ready to make the call. And Bonnie's like, I mean, really? I mean, don't you need your energy time for something else right now? I mean,
yeah.
You don't have to save everybody. Fuck, you're right. But everything is always about helping. So should I forgive myself for wanting to help? No, I think it's very sweet.
It's a very positive.
Very intent. Sweet. It's very mm-hmm. sweet. I mean, and the other thing that's interesting, the shame though is harder. Mm-hmm. The shame was harder because I thought to myself, man, I am a stupid fucking idiot. That was the story running for quite a while. But then honestly, I began to realize, like, let me give you another what chaps my ass. Mm-hmm. What chaps my ass is people who say to me, usually on social media, because they don't have the fucking guts to say to me in person, motherfuckers. Usually on social media, how did you not see it? And then I look, I studied who they are and I realized,
they don't know what they're looking at.
They're in a fucking cult too. And they don't know it.
Yeah.
And that... For sure. Really helped my shame because I realized none of you fuckers understand what you're talking about.
No, totally.
Like, you're in cults.
There was somebody that asked a sort of snarky question, which I responded also snarkily. If you want to take a look at my, you might get some kick out of it. But then I saw that she was a yoga Padme Namaste. You know, and listen, I practice yoga, but there's some really culty shit.
Oh,
lineages and abuses of power in yoga. I'm like, oh, really? Shove it up your Namaste ass.
Yeah. No, it's incredible. I see people that have given all of us shit, you know, and I'm thinking, and then I look at like what they believe and I'm like, that's a cult.
Yeah.
How are your practices going?
Oh God. Listen, I don't call them practices anymore.
I don't either.
I call them just gas relief. No, that's not what I call it either. Listen, honestly, what I like yoga because I feel myself. Mm-hmm. I feel my body. I feel a sense of presence, you know, and I love doing it, but it's been a slow introduction for me back into connecting with myself. Mm-hmm. You know, it hasn't been fast because one of the things that I struggle with, I have an allergy to personal growth, a fucking allergy.
It's like, God,
I'm allergic to it.
Allergic. So, and also I have an allergy to fucking feedback. When people start giving me feedback and say, ah.
That's good though.
I don't take feedback.
Boundaries up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I got massive boundaries.
Can I give you some feedback?
Fuck that. Fuck that. You know what's so horrible? I sometimes interact with people that are from Nixium that have not deprogrammed themselves. Mm-hmm. And they start talking and they use the tech and I'm like, motherfucker. And I go, you know what? Just so you know, I'm not in there anymore. Like, I don't do this shit anymore. My dreams are full of this. And I know we spoke about this last week, My dreams are still full of like, I'm back in the fucking cult. The center looks a little different. Sometimes we're at a hotel. We're in a group sometimes. And I'm like, what the fuck are we, what am I doing here? And then I start telling people, guys, you know, Ranieri's a fucker, right? And some of them are confused. And I'm like, what the fuck is your problem? And then I think to myself, has the trial not happened yet? Where am I? Mm-hmm. What's going on? I had these really weird dreams. I used to dream about Ranieri that's gone. No more. Mm-hmm. I think I've exorcised him. But I still dream about Nancy and Lauren and different people, like higher ranks, where I'm trying to convince them. And then, of course, Claire's there getting like, she looks like she's about to explode out of you know,
she probably is somewhere.
Pent up rage that I'm even saying these things. But I have these recurring dreams still.
Can I go circle back to something? Blonde Bomber 87 said, I'm curious now that you've had space and time from when you were in and can now look at from an out perspective, when you were behind the camera filming Keith or others, did you ever have a gut reaction that things were off that you tamped down or ignored? I think I know the answer to that, but how often did that happen?
It's such a difficult question to answer because I think there's two parts of it. The one part of it is there's a journalistic perspective where crazy shit happens in front of the camera and you're fascinated and you attempt to just go, let me not judge this thing. Let me just capture this thing. And then we'll see where it goes. That's sort of this photojournalist, news cameraman in me. I do know that there were times where I felt awkward, uncomfortable. I remember getting sleepy with certain things. There were certain things just like, I can't make sense of things. But the problem was that I thought that I had to make sense of something. And so the onus was on me to make sense of the thing that didn't make sense.
Right. Like there's something wrong with you if you didn't get it.
Right. Yeah. And in retrospect, a lot of it was basically shit that didn't make any sense. And now I'm like, there never was any sense. And this is one of the issues I think with people when they're looking at people that have these kind of severe pathologies, you know, like antisocial disorder or psychopathy, sociopathy, that kind of thing, is they're trying to apply normal emotional logic to like, what is going on here? And they can't come up with a good answer. But the answer in the end is what you're looking at doesn't make sense.
Right.
And when that happens, you're like, oh, okay. But I constantly felt like I was dumb.
Yeah, me too.
And I wasn't smart enough to figure out what was going on. And I mean, there were times I was having very high level scientific conversations, or so I thought, with him. And I was sometimes struggling to stay ahead. Sometimes, you know, like when it came to discussing one of the more recent conversations we had in 2016 was about AI. And there I could kind of hold my own because I'd been studying a lot, you know. But most of the time, there was something where I just feel like I'm lost. I don't know what's going on.
Well, Mark, like for instance, if he talked to you about AI, and I think if you started to venture into a domain that he knew he didn't understand as well as you, he would do something like, the real question might be is, why are you asking? Why does it matter?
Yeah. 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 Always. Always the way out.
As a humanitarian, that is the ultimate question to anything that we do. And then you'd be like, yeah. Okay. That's probably true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dickhead.
Yeah. You know, it is interesting. I was thinking about just what I was saying earlier about, you know, exercising him. It's really way better to, because I know there were some other questions about this as well. It's way better than it used to. I think I was consumed by thinking about all the head fucking he had done to me in 2017, 18, and 19. But after the trial, you know, after facing him in the trial, in that moment, you know, when I first saw him in the courtroom and that sort of face off, and then after basically saying what I said in court and, you know, being pummeled by his fucking defense attorneys, I started to let go of the obsessing about thinking about him and the damage. Mm. And so now the only thing that I find myself doing is sometimes I'll read something or I'll think about something and I'll have a thought or I'll read something and I'll say, it sounds just like what fucking Ranieri would say. Mm-hmm. And then I'll have to say to myself, okay, but what if it has nothing to do with him? Sometimes I'll still have to do that because although the emotional hook isn't there anymore, intellectually, there are still sentences and words in my head.
Triggers.
But I have to figure out, triggers. Like whose word is this? Is this mine? Mm-hmm. Is this his? What do I believe? And I have to do the process of, well, what do I believe? What do I think about this thing? Because he used a lot of stuff that was, as you guys have talked about in the podcast, he used a lot of stuff that was pre-existing. Yeah. Not only in personal growth, but in, you know, in science and psychology and a whole bunch of different things.
I told you about the book.
Which one?
Power versus Force. I told you about that.
Yes.
Right? I mean, like almost verbatim.
Yes. Yes.
Almost verbatim. Even the metaphors were similar. And the example of Roger Bannister breaking the 4-minute mile is
we're pretty sure he took a leap for human beings.
Right out of the book.
I know there was a time yeah. early on, I don't remember how, maybe within the year of us getting out, that I felt like you and I weren't on the same page in regards to, do we throw the baby out with the bathwater, or do we find what's good in this? And I know for me now, I'm at the point where, like, I spent 12 years, I got to find out what's good. I just try to figure out where that good came from, so I don't have to go, thank you, Vanguard, after I use a specific tool. Where are you at now with, like, is there anything that you take from our time there in terms of skills that you learned or practices or, you know, goal setting, or is anything that's still in your life?
I want to just answer something else first and then address that. Like, what I finally realized intellectually at first, and then it really hit home, I think, the beginning of this year, is that idealized version of me that he sold me. I finally understood how that worked, the selling of that. And then I finally realized that all the goodness that I had projected on him was never his.
Yes.
And that has sunk in very, very deeply. Because there's that picture of me that I posted some time ago. And Sarah, I know I've showed it to you. Maybe Nipi, I have showed you as well. It's me as a little boy sitting on a rock in South Africa. And I look at that kid and I'm like, there's so much goodness and sweetness in that little boy. And that's more of like who I feel like I am inside. And that I finally took back.
Oh, thank God.
Because my process this year has been so amazing, because I threw everything out. I'm sort of going towards the end of what you would probably talk about in the podcast. But my process this year has been so interesting, because I was in so much pain November, December of last year. So many betrayals, you know, it was so profound. It just brought me to my knees, and I went off social media for a while. And then the only solace I had was basically I would go down to the ocean and just sit in a rock and just, you know, stare at the waves, until one day I finally felt this beautiful feeling inside of me, this kind of like almost like a humming warmth. And I was like, all right, that's the feeling my whole life I've been searching for. And it really struck me that has always been there. It's always been mine. Not that I own it or that it's my identity, but it's always been available. And I kept on looking to people like him and others to give me that. That really severed a lot of the emotional and delusional spiritual strands that were still there. And so I no longer feel connected to any of the people in terms of having knowledge that I somehow need. And I don't feel that way about the tech as well. Because the problem with the tech, I had this argument with a bunch of different people that were just waking up. The reason they keep holding on to the tech is because they had an experience of themselves that they think only comes through the tech and only comes through the facilitators or the Vanguard or the prefect or the whatever. And I say to them, the common denominator of all your great experiences in your life is you. Therefore, it must be you.
Yes.
Because you can have it even without that person and even without that tech. So I don't feel attached to any of the tech. I think that it's more trouble than it's worth. And I think it's far healthier for me just to go try and figure out, like, who am I? Because we all know this. We went through this period of like, I don't know who the fuck I am.
Oh, yeah.
Who the fuck am I? All we knew was, this is a war and we're fighting. And that's all we knew, right?
Yeah.
For a while.
Full on PTSD.
Well, also, what we wanted was bad because it was an attachment.
Yeah.
Well, that was before
that
we
was
left.
A crime as well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I feel happily attached to lots of things.
No, that's
now.
What we were indoctrinated into believing. I told Sarah this last week. It's like, now that I'm auditioning and working a little bit and stuff like that, I'm re-owning my dreams a little bit.
Yeah. No, that's beautiful. It's so beautiful. And I heard Moira Penza saying that she sees that, you know, so many of us are doing so well, which is true. It's beautiful.
Yeah. No, I mean, I was telling Sarah before this, it's, you know, Bonnie
she's on fire,
is working in
fire.
She's working in the biggest shows
that
in
makes so
the world right now.
Yeah.
You know,
it's insane.
We're all hitting our stride, and anyone who hasn't shed their skin of this Nexium Keith Raniere thing is doing worse. In fact, they're exponentially worse.
Yeah, they are.
It's hard. It's hard to watch.
It's hard. You know, I know that they think I'm Satan basically, but if they just understood what they want, they already have. And they don't need him for it.
Right.
It would really help them.
It would really. And just to cut the cord of dependency, even just to have the recognition, like, we were taught dependency is bad. And yet, like, we don't be dependent on anything except for the Vanguard. That chaps my ass, by the way. Like, that was such an inconsistency.
And so it should.
Yeah. When we were in it, we're going, wait, dependency was like, you're not supposed to be dependent on coffee. You're not supposed to be dependent on alcohol, anything. You can't. It's an attachment. But
he did Red Bull all the time.
Yeah, right. And was apparently having sex all the time. That's a whole separate chaps my ass.
But it was for them.
It was for their growth.
It was for their growth.
It was for their growth. For the women's growth. Sorry, not for him. Hey there. Hope you're enjoying the episode. Quick reminder to follow us on Instagram. You can also share your favorite episodes with friends who may or may not be in a cult, and also reach out to us to let us know who you would love to hear as a guest. And now, a word from our sponsors. Our team at A Little Bit Culty Podcasts loves the Blood Ties podcast because it is gritty and current and fascinating. It's also a little bit culty. Blood Ties, the award-winning audio drama from Wondery, returns for its third season, Strange Days, with another thrilling story about greed, power, and deception. 5 years have passed since Eleanor, played by Julian Jacobs of Community, took over as CEO of the infamous Richland family empire, alongside her half-brother, Santino, played by Christian Navarro of 13 Reasons Why. Together, they decide to invest the family fortune in a groundbreaking, controversial new drug. But as shocking revelations about the new treatment emerge, Eleanor and Santino go to every length to protect their control of the Richland family dynasty. As Eleanor's father always said, medicine is a bloody business. Listen to Blood Ties, Season 3, Strange Days, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or you can binge the whole series now, early and ad-free, by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
I don't know if you guys remember my my talk at his sentencing.
Remind me.
I said something like, contrary to what your lawyers say, apparently you do need to coerce people to have sex. You know, I was like, I did not hold back.
What was that like to see him? I'm envious a little bit about, I mean, I was so glad I didn't have to go to the trial, but also was like really wanted that closure.
I'm glad you didn't as well.
Yeah, it would not have been fun.
No, it was not fun. Sarah, it was not fun. It was horrible.
Wasn't a good scene.
One of the worst experiences of my life, having to sit in that courtroom for like as long as I did. That was all, you know, obviously traumatic. I mean, you sat with him for a while, but going into court and seeing him, and I spoke about this to somebody else, like when I sat down and he was there and they'd prepped me really well and I saw him and I didn't want to look at him, but then I was required to look at him and they said, could you say his name? And I said, Mr. Ranieri. And it's so funny. I thought to myself, what the fuck am I saying Mr. Ranieri for? Fucking asshole. Can't fucking believe I was in my head yelling at myself, don't call him Mr. Ranieri. God damn it. He doesn't deserve respect. And then I remember they asked me to point at him. And when they asked me to do that, it's like just this, it was like I had a fucking laser in my finger and it's fucking pointed at him. And I kept my finger pointed at him, apparently longer than I should have. And afterwards, the FBI agent said, well, you really held that finger. And I'm like, yep. And they said, they were kind of impressed because I was so, all this nervous energy just came out in this moment of like cold rage.
Yeah. Well, he's biting pillow right now. That makes you feel better.
Biting pillow. Oh, why does that make me laugh so much?
That's what they do in prison.
Why does that make me laugh so much?
Because there's no gaslighting there.
Mark, I wouldn't have gone through the last 4 years had not been for Nippy's obscene sense of humor. That just,
oh my God. And you know what I was thinking about, by the way? Yeah. And I don't know that you guys remember much. I don't remember a lot, but I do know we did laugh.
We did.
I mean, I know that in 2017 and 18, I know we laughed about stuff as well.
Yeah, you have to.
That's what I do. I manufacture laughter everywhere I go. I was like, this place is a fucking funeral home. Let's have some fun here.
Yeah, we have to find pockets.
Well, that's another thing. Some of the people that were supposedly at odds with now, I had some of my best belly laughs ever. That's not changing in my psychology. Right. Sometimes when I think about them, I'm like, I laugh really hard with a lot of those people. So I don't know. It can be both.
Yeah, you got me thinking as well, Nip, because one of the things that, there's not a lot of things I miss at all.
Well, I still think they feel wronged by us. I mean, you have to understand the campaign against all of us.
It's pretty rough.
You know, and maybe they'll come around. Some I've spoken to, some have just sent me a text, some have been whatever. I mean, most of them have been, I get it.
Yeah.
Here's what I think where most of them are at, and not to say don't take it personally, because listen, I take a lot of things personally. But just to remember that even if they're out and they know that Keith is bad, yes, they stuck around for the campaign of like Sarah and Mark are destructive. For some of them, a year. And that's a long time to be indoctrinated with a belief. So I know there's people who are out who understand that Keith is a sociopath or whatever, but still think how we handled it wasn't right in some way.
The other thing they don't recognize sometimes is they don't seem to understand that this thing was escalating.
Yeah.
And where it would have gone was so much worse than where it had been.
Deaths.
Yeah, deaths. Well, there already was death.
Yeah. It was already
happening, yeah.
They also fail to recognize that when the bomb of Keith Ranieri was going to go off, or whenever it was going to go off, and it was, all of us were going to have shrapnel.
Yeah. Yeah. And they,
all
by the
of
way,
us. We all still do to a certain
I don't
extent.
Know if they know, but we got a lot of shrapnel. Yeah. It hasn't been a fucking bed of
no,
roses.
No, this is yeah. this yeah. this path of public like de-shaming or whatever you want to call it.
And you know, Sarah, I want to kind of remind the audience because I think people see this, but like when we were in June, July, August, when we were trying to get this New York Times article out, you know, each one of us, we were a formidable army together and each one of us had a very distinct role.
Yeah.
And what people don't seem to understand sometimes, or maybe they forget, is that you decided, okay, I'm going to take one for the team and I'm going to show what happened. And as a woman to do that, that's really hard. That's really, really fucking difficult. And, you know, people don't, they don't give enough kudos to a woman who's been through something that would have crushed most people to come out and say, I will do whatever it takes and I will, yes, I'll be the face of this thing. You know, that's hard. That's hard. I mean, we all had our role and, you know, all the roles were hard, but that one was like, it's hard because I know how I felt. We're such public figures now. You know, we said, okay, fine, fuck it. We're just going to document everything. And like, this is the cautionary tale so that nobody ever has to go through this kind of shit again. And that's hard. And then it's hard when you see yourself, the whole world sees your pain, but it's really hard. It's really hard as the woman that basically showed her brand, you know, that's hard.
It was.
And I mean, it's hard for all of us, but that's, I feel like people sometimes don't get it. You know, it's not like this thing of like, yay, look at me. I'm going to show myself to the world. No, it's fucking awful.
Yeah.
It's fucking awful.
I'm pretty intolerant of critics of that.
Yeah.
It's been documented a little
but
bit.
I'm sure I'm glad that I did. And for all the challenge and pain that came with it, it was fucking worth it because 120, it was worth it. 120.
Absolutely worth it.
Well, here's the deal. For people who think 120 is a little extreme, my response is don't worry. He's not going to serve all of it.
No, it's true. That's true.
And I was going to say this at the end, Mark, but I'll say it right now because it seems appropriate. But and many people have said this to me since the vow and, you know, being public that I'm saying this to you as well, is that it was your goodness. It was your goodness that you had the whole time because that's what allowed the light to be shone on what was dark, I think. So
yeah,
you had it the whole time.
No, I mean, a lot of what you did set up our punches.
You know, I want to talk about that for a second because like, as you guys know, I love my wife with everything in my being. And thank God she had the strength and fortitude to do what she did. And then the other thing that's so interesting is this whole situation has made me believe in predetermination again, because I didn't. And it's made me kind of start to think about fate and free will, because it was incredible what happened, you know?
Yes.
I mean, think about it. So you know, Bonnie has her wake up and she's pushing me and pushing me and pushing me and pushing me. And suddenly I crack. And then I'm like, you know, Sarah, I'm talking to you. And then we're talking to Nippy. And then we're talking to this one. And then just explodes, right? And then most people never get where we got because most people get shut down.
Yeah.
The fact that we got the prosecutors on board, the fact that we got the FBI team on board, you know, the state police, the IRS agents, all these people, this incredible team of people. And the fact that he got prosecuted and that this case is now being used as a template.
As precedent.
For precedent, not only for R. Kelly, but for many others coming up. It's kind of fucking miraculous. It's kind of like, what
it is
the
pretty amazing.
Fuck is going on?
Mark, the most powerful part of the vow for me, and the time I cried pretty much, I mean, the hardest or felt it the most, was when Bonnie went to you and put your relationship on the line. Mm-hmm. And said, you're going to have to do that part without me. Mm-hmm. Boo. Mm-hmm. And it was profound for me because it was the ultimate act of love, right? Mm-hmm. She was able to just go, I love you, but I can't love you like this. Mm-hmm. And to me, and I wrote you text. It's the only time I've responded. You know, it's the most powerful part of the entire documentary for me. And I'm so glad it was captured because that powerful moment of coming from that place of risking everything
out of love,
I think set off a chain of events.
Yeah.
That was the through line.
Catalyst.
Of it.
Yeah.
Your love, you know, your love, the love for Bonnie was the catalyst to you. You go to Sarah and Sarah makes the right decision because of you. Mm-hmm. And then Sarah comes to me and I was kind of like a dog you had to kind of keep in. But there was love in there. There's love in there. I mean, I'm coming from the right place. I'm protecting my family, but you know, and if I have to be a little obnoxious to do it, I was willing to do that. You're not going to dictate to me how I protect my family. Yeah. So that's to me, my love and how I show it. Yeah. Right. And then I think that's a pretty powerful force in, you know, to your point of chain of events. I think that informs law enforcement. They know that we're not people that are clandestine. Yeah. They know that this is, and if there's something to write here, you know, the justice system in its way upheld the right principle.
Yeah. Yeah.
However clumsily and however clumsy our justice systems are, it still did it. And it still said,
this isn't okay.
We live in a society where this isn't okay.
Right.
And hopefully, you know, that will continue and, you know, having these conversations and highlighting Moira Penz is doing her job.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And if you meet her, she's full of love.
She's amazing.
You know? She's To me, it's from that moment of like, you know, because I didn't know all this.
Yeah.
A lot of it was the first time I was seeing it, you know? So it was very powerful for me.
Yeah. The way I see it as well is honestly, Bonnie's love saved my life. You know,
ours.
Saved ours.
Yes, saved ours.
That's my. That's what I'm saying to you. I wrote that in that text after it happened. It saved everything. And to me, you know, when she got Star Wars and all that stuff, I just think everything's coming back to her in spades because she put out and she's getting back what she's putting
and in also spades. The irony is not lost on me because I know how much you love Star Wars and how that drew you to Bonnie to begin with, and how what's the message? Light wins, love wins.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So here we are.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. It's been an insanely interesting year. It really, really has, you know.
Oh, a modern domestic woman said, what kind of words of encouragement can you give to people still trying to forgive themselves for being part of an abusive community? Mm. What have you learned?
Yeah, look, I keep on harping back on that these leaders with these pathologies, they know who to target. Mm-hmm. And by and large, what I've seen now in meeting so many people from other groups is there's, as I said, there's all this beautiful goodness. There's all this idealism that's so wonderful. And it's important to remember why you went into this thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like I really have this deep appreciation now for this quest in my life. I've had this quest my whole life. And it's a beautiful quest. And did I misunderstand something? Yes, I misunderstood. As a little child, and I thought that I was bad. And so my quest was informed from this painful place. It was spurred on by this pain. So what? Who cares? Everybody's got some pain. Everybody's trying to feel better or to try to change something or whatever it is. That's beautiful. You know, and I say to people that like are still beating themselves up, did you spend your childhood like figuring out how to torture bunnies or, you know, No, you didn't. You were trying to like do something better, be something better, whatever it was. And for whatever reason, you know, this whole thing of like, oh, it came from a deficient place. You know what? Fuck off. Yeah. Who fucking cares where it came from? It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. I hate the word deficient.
Oh, I can't stand that word. And it was so fucked up because he even showed us the Stanford prison experiment as what can go wrong. And because we saw that, we thought, okay, well, that's not what this is because he would never do that. That's why he's showing us the problem. And maybe it was much more nefarious and he was showing it to us because he was like, you guys are such fucking idiots. This is what's happening, but you're too stupid, whatever the reason was. So he literally inoculated us against seeing what was actually going on. I mean, I was studying, you know, the work of Robert J. Lifton, you know, about totalitarianism and like cults and shit while I was in a cult.
Yeah.
Me and Lauren and Nippy, you as well.
We would say, when we saw other groups, we'd be like, that seems like a cult.
Yes, we were studying cults in a cult. That's how nefarious it was. But the thing is, I keep on going back to like, what was your motivation? And honestly, for the most part, I see people's motivation was really good and sweet and kind. Maybe it was delusional. Okay, so we're all delusional.
Well, idealistic. And that has negative and positive connotations, depending on what you believe.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
But that's where we connected, you know, when I met you.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, big visions, changing the world with conscious shifting media. Like, hey, guess what? Guess what, Mark? We did it.
It happened.
We did it.
It happened.
High five. Yeah. Hashtag.
High five.
Okay, everybody. We are going to take a little pause here for about a week, leave you waiting with bated breath for part two. Until then, let us know what you thought of this episode on Instagram and have a great week.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean.
Let's keep the conversation going. We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO.
If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, like, take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. It takes a second. We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.